It is Tuesday, April 22nd, 2014. My name is Mila Cedar, and I am on vacation from elementary school. So I insisted my dad to take time off to learn how to sing Let It Go. Let it go, let it go, can't hold it back anymore. It is... So today you are listening to the Best of the Majority Report.
That's right, folks. Last day of vacation. Mila goes back to school tomorrow. I come back to the show. Our final best of Martin Gillins from October of 2013. Martin Gillins, of course, wrote one of the seminal papers on how our income inequality, really, we see it in the context of political inequality. He's recently come out with another paper that takes us even a little further. So let's go back as we talk about this in the future to Martin Gillins. And we'll be back live tomorrow. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program author of Why Americans Hate Welfare and Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, Professor Martin Gillins of Princeton. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
So now I got to start by saying that I think that your research over the past 2.5 years has been the single most referenced research on this program. And in just about every book that I have read on income inequality and its relevance to what we're dealing with in our politics. So I'm very excited to have you on the program. Thanks again for joining us.
Well, terrific. I'm glad to hear that. I think it's an incredibly important topic. So glad it's getting attention.
Now, with that said, before we get to that, and also your book, Why Americans Hate Welfare, which I think is as relevant today as it was when you wrote it over a decade ago, your thoughts on the government shutdown? Apparently, it's making a lot of news today.
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, boy, it sure underlines the dysfunctional nature of our system and the power of the polarized political conditions to wreak havoc on our politics. You know, we have a government that's well designed, perhaps, for situations where there's a reasonable amount of agreement, but not well designed for situations where small minorities can put up roadblocks, and we're seeing the consequences of that.
You know, I want to circle back on the dynamic that's taking place now, because In some ways, at the very least, it is, I guess, in some ways, it doesn't necessarily fit. If the conventional wisdom is right about the dynamic in the House, it doesn't necessarily fit with your research. And you know, there may be a myriad of reasons for that, but we'll circle back to that. I want to start with affluence and influence. your research basically describes the dynamic of moving from a plutonomy to a plutocracy. I mean, is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it.
Just tell us about what you found as you started to research how policy in this country reflects the preferences of the public versus specific subsets of the public.
Well, I was mostly focusing on affluence and how people with more resources have more political influence. Now, I, of course, expected going in to find that people with higher incomes and greater wealth would have more say over government policy, but I didn't expect the almost complete lack of influence of not only poor Americans, but of the middle class. And I think that's the most striking and troubling result of the analysis that I did, looking at the preferences of the public and the nature of government policymaking between the 1960s and the early 2000s. And we just find that under most circumstances, what the middle class or the poor prefer bears no relationship to what the government does. And it's only when they agree with affluent Americans that they see the policies they prefer being adopted.
How did you determining this?
Well, I collected survey data where people were asked about whether they would favor or oppose some specific change in federal government policy. And I looked at surveys across the wide range of policy domains, from economic policy to sort of social policies, foreign military engagements, raising the minimum wage, tax policy, everything I could get my hands on from the mid-1960s and then from the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. And for each of those policies, and there were a couple thousand of them, each of those policies I had data on what poor people, middle-class Americans, and the affluent preferred. And I had a team of research assistants over a period of years then helped me figure out which of those policies were adopted. And what I found was that the likelihood of a policy being adopted was strongly related to what people at the top of the income distribution said they wanted. And once those preferences were taken into account, bore no relationship, except under unusual circumstances, to what middle-class or low-income Americans preferred.
Can you give us a sense of what, at least broadly speaking, what those preferences were? I mean, I presume they cut across a bunch of different issues, but, I mean, is there a way to sort of in some way summarize the nature of the preferences?
In a nutshell, I'd say the most consistent preferences are, first, what you would expect, which is that economic policies that are more beneficial to low-income Americans have stronger support among the poor, and those policies that are more beneficial to the affluent, such as, say, the Bush tax cuts or the elimination of the inheritance tax, get more support among the affluent. So those kinds of economically redistributive policies. Second area is government regulation. Affluent Americans are just much less enthusiastic about government regulation of industry than is the middle class or the poor. And finally, on social policies, we have a sort of opposite political dynamic, where affluent Americans tend to be more liberal on things like abortion policy, gay rights, stem cell research, these sorts of things. But in all of these cases, whether the policies align more with the Democratic Party's traditional commitments of a progressive economic agenda or the Republican Party's traditional commitments of a less progressive economic agenda, whatever it is, I found the pattern to be the same, which is to say the preferences of the affluent are more likely to be found in government policies than those of other Americans.
How over time, I mean, you examine this over the course of a 40-year period or so, was it consistent throughout, or was there some difference? Is this a dynamic that is becoming more pronounced?
I found two kinds of changes. One was a sort of gradual increase across that time period in the apparent influence of affluent Americans over federal government policy. But the other change that I saw was not consistent and fluctuated depending on political conditions. And those were the conditions that I've alluded to, where there are some exceptions where the middle class and even the poor have greater influence than in other conditions. I should be clear, under no conditions does the middle class have as much influence over policymaking as the affluent, nor does the poor have as much influence as the middle class. But there are variations in how unequal that influence is. And in particular, when there's a presidential election looming, or when control of government is closely divided and it's sort of uncertain who will control Congress going forward, those are the conditions when the responsiveness to the public is broader and there's relatively more ability of a sort of broader swath of Americans to shape policy outcomes.
Essentially when they need votes.
Exactly.
And that explains why we hear a lot more sort of populist economic rhetoric in the run-up to an election, and then all of a sudden it just sort of melts away.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, and that's certainly true in 2012. And to some degree, it's reflected in policy. Although I will say a very interesting finding from not my research but others is that those policies that are adopted in the run-up to an election tend to have less staying power than policies adopted at other times. So there is a greater responsiveness to public preferences, but it's less enduring.
Interesting. And how does that, I mean, the social issues, I think it's, we're at a very interesting time, I think, in terms of the way that the worm has turned on the sort of this, on the more social issues, the ones that have been more associated with progressives, because in many respects, a lot of these battles seem to be coming, at least in terms of policy, to a close. I mean, maybe it's a little premature to say that, but a lot of things seem to be being taken off the table in some respects. And I wonder if the if there's anything that you've observed in the way that Democrats in particular have used these social issues. I mean, both parties have used these social issues to their benefit. But it occurs to me that when we look at like the Clinton administration and even to a certain extent, the Obama administration, the use of social issues to sort of, hide, as a consolation for the economic policies that they, at least in the run-up to elections, tout. We seem to have almost come to a place where a lot of that has consummated. Does that make any sense?
That could well be the case. I mean, it's certainly true that both parties are trying to sort of cobble together coalitions of voters, and by combining, you know, positions, in the case of the Democratic Party, positions on economic issues that are more appealing to the middle class, but positions on social issues that are more appealing to the affluent. And of course, for the Republican Party, it's the reverse. And so, yes, the balance of the attention to these different kinds of issues will change depending on circumstances and, you know, which elements of a coalition the parties are most in need of support from.
And so what is, I mean, the obvious solution to this dynamic is to sort of diminish, I guess, the influence of money in politics. But is it that simple, or, I mean, and is that one of your prescriptions?
It is, although the truth is we don't really know a lot about how different kinds of campaign finance policies and so on can affect those dynamics. So there's been a history both in the states and at the federal level of campaign finance reforms that have proven ineffective because both the incumbent politicians, the parties, and the people who want to influence policy are very clever at finding ways around these restrictions. And so I think there's been a number of proposals that have been put forth but never adopted for stricter versions of campaign finance and ways to really kind of squeeze the money out of politics We don't seem to be moving in that direction. In fact, quite the opposite, at least at the federal level. But you're quite right. I think that's the most important. In some sense, it's the issue against which all other political issues will hinge.
And we should say that your research was done prior to Citizens United. It is obviously prior to, we don't know how this McCutcheon case, which is going to basically could remove limitations, aggregate limitations on giving. But is this dynamic simply a function of how much money is spent on elections, or is it also something to do with the classes that are represented in office and in our media?
Well, I mean, you're quite right. It's not simply the amount of money, but the sources of that money. And it comes overwhelmingly from, of course, the most affluent Americans. And increasingly, with things like Citizens United, that money will be more and more concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer individuals. So the source of money is the critical factor here. I think we need policies that can help us to reverse course and bring in larger numbers of smaller donors, less affluent individuals into the political process. The truth is that there are some factors. I mean, the internet's probably the most important one that make raising money from, many, many small donors more feasible. And we have seen some movement in that direction, so I think there's some reason for hope, but at the same time, the ability and willingness of these, plutocrats to, use their resources to buy the political policies that benefit them has also increased, and that's it's not going to be an easy thing to push back against.
How much awareness do those people whose political views are underrepresented in policy outcomes, how much awareness is there of this dynamic? I mean, obviously
there's actually a lot. I mean, I've looked at surveys that ask people things like, does government listen to the views of people like me? And it's quite striking that the more income people have, the more likely they are to say that government listens to people like them. So it's clear that the public is aware that money talks in politics, and that if you're not one of these rich donors, then you're standing by the sidelines.
But I mean, is there an awareness that it's a function of their class? In other words, I can be a titan of industry and say, I find government to be very responsive, and not necessarily make that connection between, and it's because I come from a class of people who influence government policy more.
Yeah, I mean, that is true, and I'm sure there are people who sort of attribute it to other factors. For example, there's an argument that, well, middle-class Americans or poor people don't really vote that much, and maybe they don't really care that much about politics, and so maybe that's the reason why their views aren't being reflected in government policy. But I've looked at that, other scholars have looked at that, and that just doesn't bear out. And it's also true that people are quite cynical about government and about who government responds to, and we've seen that cynicism increase over the past few decades as well.
And certainly, in terms of the voting rates, I mean, we're seeing, I think, the low income people voting at rates that are, at least in the past several decades, at extremely high rates.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly been no big drop off in voter turnout. And no sort of shift away from the involvement of the poor or the middle class, for that matter.
Do you think there's been, what is curious to me is if there is this awareness that government is functioning more and more at the behest of the wealthy, and at a time when we're talking about enormous income inequality, a limited group of people. I mean, are we seeing, aside from a certain amount of cynicism or an awareness when you're asked a question as to whether or not your views are represented, I mean, is it surprising to you that we're not seeing more sort of, and maybe we're seeing it from our perspective, but I sit in a fairly sort of myopic perch here. Are we seeing as much class consciousness and organizing as you would imagine in this instance?
Well, I mean, I would like to see more, but it's not a strong tradition in America, and unions have declined considerably, private sector unions in particular, over the past 50 years, and so we don't have as much sort of organizational capacity. Is it surprising? On the one hand, I'd say, yeah, it is, because clearly so many Americans are suffering, and we've seen how government responds to the needs of, the financial elite and so on over the last 2 years. I think there is a cynicism, but maybe there's also a sense of, and it goes along with the cynicism, that there's not really much that can be done. And so people just go about their lives and hope for the best.
Let's turn to your earlier book, Why Americans Hate Welfare: Race, Media, and the Politics of Anti-Poverty Policy. Because in some ways, I think the dynamic that you found in that research continues well. I mean, it obviously continues to play out today, but I think in some respects it plays out in specifically what we're seeing in terms of this government shutdown. Talk to us about what you found. Why do Americans hate welfare?
Well, when I started that work, I had assumed that two of the big reasons would be that they don't want to pay for it, on the one hand, and that they don't really believe that that's government's role, this sort of rugged individualism. And neither of those things turned out to be true. It turns out that based on how Americans respond to surveys and other kinds of evidence, that in fact people do think government has an important role in helping the disadvantaged and in getting people sort of back on their feet, and that middle-class Americans are willing to pay taxes to support anti-poverty programs. So why do they hate welfare if it's not those things? Well, it turns out that they think most people currently on welfare, and this is remains true going back many decades, but most people who are receiving welfare don't really need it. So there's a cynicism about how genuine the needs are, and that cynicism is driven in large measure by racial stereotypes, by misperceptions of the sort of extent to which African Americans compose the welfare rolls, and to the stereotype of blacks as less committed to the work ethic than other Americans.
And so we see at one point in the history of welfare programs, basically a significant number of Americans saying, I have no problem with welfare, I just don't want all these black people getting it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they say that, and they might not even think it consciously, for at least some. But nevertheless, it's very clear that the greater the misperception about the extent to which welfare recipients are black, the greater opposition to welfare among white Americans.
I mean, we see this, I mean, even today. I mean, you did this book 10 years ago or so, but, 5 minutes of listening to Rush Limbaugh, you hear about President Obama's slush fund and about, the lazy people that Obama has just been elected by because they want to get free money from him. I mean, this is a dynamic that's still in play. And in many respects, this is what we're seeing with the government shutdown, aren't we?
Maybe so. I mean, it's a little bit hard to know. Of course, the ostensible focus has been on the health care laws. My own view is that public opposition to those laws is probably not particularly race-based, although I don't really have strong evidence on that. But I think, the Republicans and the right in general have done a good job of sort of muddying the waters about what the nature of the health care laws are, as they did in the 90s when the Clinton health care reforms failed.
But, I mean, if you're shutting down the government, and we're seeing all sorts of these Tea Party Republicans talking about there's no problem in shutting down the government. There's no problem. And then, you know, let's go backwards, too. There's no problem with the sequester. And we've seen this dynamic, you know, play out over the past 7 months, which, you know, the idea being that any of those people are being helped, whether they are children on and pregnant mothers on nutrition assistance, whether it's people receiving food stamps, whether it's things like Head Start. It seems to me that there's this sense that this is just all waste from their perspective. It's just this is all stuff we don't need to deal with. And in fact, our society is largely ignoring the devastation that's being wrought in different communities around the country because of things like the sequester. We're going to see this also when it comes to the government shutdown. And yet it gets very little attention and particularly from the right, a tremendous amount of scorn.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I do think it's a sort of broader cynicism and, you know, belief that the government wastes a lot of our money, sort of a lack of awareness in some cases about what the government actually does do, what the money is spent on. But in any case, the sense that, well, you know, we can do without government for a while. And it may take actual, you know, programs that affect people's lives in very direct ways for people to, you know, really start screaming about it.
Did what we've seen with the sequester and the cuts that essentially were, I guess, originally, I guess, sort of contemplated to hit across society because this was going to be, you know, simply a percentage off the top of all government operations, which over the course of the first month or two of the sequester, anything that really impacted wealthy people was immediately fixed. Mm-hmm. And anything that impacted poor people was considered to be really not so bad. I mean, this seems to play into again into that this dynamic of the policy preferences of different classes of people, and it also we don't just see it in terms of the policy, and it's hard to say which comes first, the chicken or the egg, but also in the context of the way the media reported on it.
Yeah, no, I agree completely, and I do think the media are kind of culpable here, and you know, not you know, really trying to bring to the public's attention what the meaning and the consequences of these policies like the sequester are, and I blame that partly on the Democrats as well. That you know, for the sorts of reasons we've been discussing, the role of money in politics, that you know, they haven't made the kind of statements to the public, the kind of appeals that they ought to. In terms of the way that these kinds of cutbacks, government shutdown, and so on, affects people's lives.
In fact, we're looking at the clean continuing resolution that the Democrats are seeking at this point is far closer to the Paul Ryan budget than it is even to the center of the president's budget.
Yeah, it's a sad commentary.
It is indeed. All right. Well, I appreciate your time today, Professor. And give me a sense of what do you think happens now in terms of the shutdown and the debt ceiling? I mean, do you have any sense of where this goes in terms of politics? And or I guess let me ask you this. I'm sorry to meander here a little bit, but the how much does this shutdown, when we see that, you know, even the Chamber of Commerce is supposedly upset about this, it seems to me that the policy preference here of the wealthy would be to not have the government shut down, to not have the debt ceiling basically being used in this the manner that we're seeing the Republicans use. How do you reconcile that dynamic with your research? I mean, seeing a change here in terms of who's running the Republican Party and thereby the rest of our government in some respects?
You know, it's two things. One is that it's not the majority of the Republican Party. It's a relatively small number of extremists, but it's enough of them given the nature of the way that the House is run, and Boehner's concern with his position as Speaker to exert an oversized influence on government policy. Now, how long can that go on with this relatively small minority, and as you point out, against the preferences and the interests of much of the business sector as well. And my guess is that it won't go on for very long. Whether there'll be a face-saving compromise from the Democrats in the White House, or whether the Republicans will simply steamroll their extremist wing, remains to be seen. But I agree. I think the consequences are too great, and the influence of people who would suffer those consequences, especially the business community, are such that we will see a resolution, and we will not see a weeks-long government shutdown.
But how do you reconcile the idea that stipulated that we're talking about a minority within the Republicans? Although I'm not so convinced, because the reality is that Boehner's making a choice here, and he may be making a choice that saves his speakership for a while. But there's other choices he could make, and it's certainly the wealthy are not necessarily concerned with him being the speaker as opposed to anybody else if he can't do their bidding. We have one minority that has oversized influence versus another minority that has oversized influence, and there's a different minority that's winning this time around. Is this a trend? Because we have the minority that we're talking about being the sort of the base of the Republican Party in some respects seems to be fairly well entrenched in a way that even in 95, 96, they weren't. There's only, I think, 17 House seats where President Obama won and is represented by a Republican. So it seems that they are at least electorally entrenched, and their constituents don't seem to have a problem with what they're doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you're right. I think there's a small group, and I think they're pursuing their own individual interests, not the interests of their party, and certainly not the interests of the country. We'll have to see. I mean, it does seem like it's the new normal, but I hope that'll turn out not to be the case.
All right. Well, Professor Martin Gillins, thank you so much. We have links up to both your books, Why Americans Hate Welfare and Affluence and Influence. Thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Nice talking with you.